Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm very pleased to say we have Fergal McGarry on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Rising, Ireland, Easter 1916. Sometimes, when you lose, you win. This was the case for the relatively small group of Irish Republicans who decided to launch an assault on what was then British-controlled Ireland. They were in relatively desperate straits as their enemies, the Nationalists, had succeeded in gaining a kind of home rule for Ireland. This really took the wind out of the Republican sails. So, as I say, in desperation, they mounted a rebellion that they knew could not succeed. It did not succeed, at least militarily, but it managed to start a kind of sea change in Irish politics, one that led to the War for Independence and the Civil War, and then finally the declaration of an independent Ireland in the South. Fergal does a terrific job of telling this story, and he does so on the basis of some really interesting new sources that he talks about in the interview. So without further ado, here it is. Hi, Fergal.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you very much. It's very hot here in the center of the United States. It's going to be 95 degrees today. What's it like there in Belfast?
It's actually unusually pleasant. It's quite warm. It's probably 20 degrees, 22 degrees. it's about as good as it gets, actually, for our summer. So
that's great.
I'm not complaining.
That's great. I should tell our listeners that we have Fergal McGarry on the show today, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Rising, Ireland, Easter 1916. As I was telling Fergal in the pre-interview, I used to live in Ireland. I had the great good fortune of teaching for a year at the University of Limerick, and I was treated very well there, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. And although I'm a Russian historian, I realized that I could learn a lot if I just listened to Irish people in pubs about Irish history. And so when I saw this book in the Oxford University Press catalog, I grabbed it quickly and called Fergal and said, I must interview you. And he was kind enough to agree to my terms, kind of on short notice, really. So I want to thank you very much. And I had to cancel once. I'm sorry about that. But my kids
no
need to be fed.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
It's my pleasure to have you. So, Fergal, why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was born in Bray, which is south of Dublin, and I studied history and Greek and Roman civilization at UCD, and currently I work at Queen's University Belfast, where I've lived for the last 8 years or so, and I teach modern Irish history. And I've specialised in that really since studying for my PhD at Trinity College Dublin back in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a quick question about that. I can only imagine that the decision to study modern Irish history in Ireland is a somewhat difficult one, in the sense that there's still a lot going on. And I was thinking, you know, we here in America, you know, we said a lot of American historians, I'm not one of them, but our history is not that consequential. People don't fight about it as much as they do in Ireland. What was it like studying or deciding to study modern Irish history?
Well, I would have gone to UCD in the for my BA, my undergraduate studies, in the late 1980s. So Irish history, I would have studied a history degree rather than Irish history, but a fair bit of it would have been composed of Irish history. And certainly Irish history was very, it was contentious and very politicized because of the Troubles. The Provisional IRA's campaign was still ongoing. The peace process didn't really start till the mid-1990s. So certainly there was, you know, there was a lot of tensions associated with Irish history, and it was also quite divisive. In that period, it was probably still the last phase of what became known as the revisionist controversy. As well, many countries have their own revisionist controversies, but the Irish one was particularly kind of contentious. It would have sort of emerged in the late 1960s and really gone on to the 1970s and 1980s. So it would have been, you know, pretty much during the same period as Republican violence was going on in Northern Ireland. So there would have been a sense, I suppose, that some people would have felt the need to take stands. It would have been quite difficult, I suppose, to teach particularly courses relating to Republican violence and campaigns for independence and so on, you know, completely dispassionately, particularly because I suppose the IRA at that time sought a good deal of legitimacy from, you know, from the history of the revolutionary mm-hmm. period. So I think even the most kind of apathetic undergraduate student would have been aware that the history that they were studying was politicized, contentious, controversial. Mm-hmm. In a sense, that kind of added quite a lot of interest to it, and the context of you know how Irish history has been taught and how it's received has continued to change quite dramatically then because of the events that followed. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure we'll probably touch on that later.
Oh, we will. Yes. Oh, yeah.
The rising is a good example of how every decade or every generation, these things are looked at quite differently, and people sort of read different things into it. So certainly, yeah, there would have been a strong sense of that Irish history is something that's not just in the past.
Uh-huh. And why did you decide to write a book about the Rising?
Well, short answer, I was commissioned to do it by Oxford University Press. I have to be honest there, hold my hands up.
I'm liking you more and more.
at that time, I was sort of coming to the end of a project which was actually I wasn't coming towards. I was in the middle of a project about Ono Duffy, and a sort of a controversial figure, a fascist in the 1930s. I had nothing specifically planned, and I was asked to write this book. And to be honest, it wouldn't have been a topic that I naturally would have thought of, because again, so just going back to childhood and the sense of Irish history that you carry around with you, 1916 would have been something that every Irish school child was very familiar with. It would have been a bit of an old chestnut that would have been mm-hmm. drummed into you for a long period. I mean, for myself, I can remember going to post-primary school and having school teachers who would teach you endlessly about Patrick Pearse in 1916, and in a way, actually, which is quite off-putting. You know, I remember having my knuckles wrapped for not being able to memorize the names of the signatories of the proclamation. So there was a kind of the attitudes to the Easter Rising were sort of still bound up, I suppose, with the still very strong sense of a kind of a Catholic nationalism that had become very much part of the orthodoxy of the state and part of independent Ireland. So if anything, I would have had, probably would have been carrying a bit of this baggage, which writing the book incidentally has helped me to work through, because largely the legacy of the Rising is, of course, nothing to do with the people which took part in it. My other concern, I suppose, about writing a history of the Easter Rising at that time was that it had been done pretty well by a couple of books. Irish historians had actually ignored the Easter Rising for a long, long period, but this had changed really in the 1990s, and there was one or two very good studies which had come out. So really there were very few questions left about the military aspects of the Rising, what had actually happened, the wider political context in terms of particularly the actions of Britain and British policy had also been received a lot of attention. So one concern I had at the time was, well, what more is there to say? And I'm sure we'll get onto it later, but because of the availability of new sources, particularly the Bureau of Military History, I found actually that there was another story that could be told, which was fortunate.
Well, and much to your credit, you say that the military aspect of the Rising has been well covered, and I appreciated that a lot. But I would want to talk a little bit about this source that you just mentioned, because it is a pretty remarkable source, and it is totally book-worthy. And also, it recently became available, and maybe you could just tell the story of this.
Sure.
This source.
Actually, despite its title, the Bureau of Military History, I mean, I've mined it extensively, actually, for non-military things, you know, primarily. But just to give you a little bit of the background, in the 1940s, the Irish government set up a project to basically record the memories of the generation of Republicans, revolutionaries who'd taken part in the Easter Rising, and they were beginning to die. Quite an extensive project was set up involving military investigators from the National Army, and they interviewed, they recorded around 1,800 witness statements. So they created a massive archive. It's about 40 archival boxes with a huge amount of statements, some of them quite long and quite detailed, with people who were involved in the IRB, the Irish Volunteers, Na Fianna, Cum na mBan, and the other revolutionary organizations. And basically each one of these individuals was asked to record what became known as a witness statement. So it was a first-person testimony in which they answered a set kind of array of questions, asking them how did they enter national life, why did they become politicized, what did they actually do within the revolutionary organizations, and so on. And then I suppose that one particularly interesting aspect of the collection is after they recorded this huge amount of information, it was put under lock and key and held by the state, closed to public access until the last of the people who had given witness statements had passed away. So the statements actually only became available in, I think it was 2002. So I would argue it's probably the most important individual single source that we have about the Irish Revolution. And amazingly enough, then it just kind of enters the public domain, 90 years after the events itself. So obviously there's a lot of difficulties with a source like this because it's oral history, and it's oral history from the remove of several decades. But on the other hand, there's nothing like it in terms of the level of intimate detail you get and the size of the sample. It's a significant proportion of people who actually took part in 1916 give witness statements. So there's quite a lot of problems with it, which I go into in the book. Mm. But it really is an exceptional source, and it's around this individual source that I built the book largely.
Yeah, I was
going to say, when I was reading about the source, I just I turned to my wife and I said, "Boy, was this guy lucky."
That was my thought too, because I'd actually agreed to write the book before I knew about the source, but before it had become available, and so it coincided quite nicely, and it turned out that there was something new or some new things to say after all about the rise.
I just think it's an incredible source. I mean, it could be mined and mined and mined. I mean, after the Russian Revolution, nobody went around. Well, maybe they did. I don't know. We don't know about it. But asking people about their experiences. Also, there's a lot. One kind of interesting thing about the source is that I don't know what the motives of the people who collected the source were, but there's a lot of unflattering stuff in there.
Yeah, I mean, just on the first point, I don't think there is any international equivalent for such a, I mean, given the relatively small scale of the Irish Revolution and the amount of people who took part in it, I don't think there's any comparable source of that kind of quantity and quality and scale that exists. So I think it's actually very interesting to people who are interested in revolutions and how they happen, and politicization and radicalism and issues like that. Sorry, what was the second point you raised there, Marshall?
Pardon me? My second point was about the unflattering stuff in the archive itself.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, in some ways, that's a cause for concern, because while the information in, by and large, in the witness statements, I think, is often reliable in the sense that people aren't being misleading, there's various problems with it. I mean, probably the single biggest problem is that a civil war took place in Ireland in 1922. So this very small unified revolutionary movement divided in two and never reconciled. So people who were giving witness statements were talking about events in which they had been fighting alongside people who had subsequently perhaps killed their comrades or even family members. So the shadow of the Civil War is just one of quite a lot of things in which you have to read quite carefully when you're looking at witness statements. Having said that, I think people who were particularly aggrieved because of the Civil War, people who maybe had become opposed to the government or governments of the 1940s, were probably more likely not to give a witness statement than to give something that would be deliberately intended to mislead. So there's lots of unflattering things in it, but it's also true to say there's lots of things which are glossed over. And I think you mentioned earlier about what a great source it is. I mean, one way in which it's going to be a great source, I think, is in looking at historical memory and how historical memory evolves and how it's shaped, because you have a lot of people in the 1940s talking about what they did in the 1920s or earlier. And there's lots of areas which really aren't touched on in the kind of detail that they should be. So, for example, when people talk about violence, they tend not to talk about questionable killings, mm-hmm. such as the killings of informers, maybe sectarian motives that would have been at play. So I think you have to read the witness statements quite carefully from that point of view. Naturally enough, a lot of people will talk about those things which they're most comfortable talking about and will not sort of will gloss over other more dubious aspects of what happened in the past.
I just marvel at anybody who can remember with any detail at all something that happened 20 years ago. I can't. I don't know about you, but I can't.
I struggled with what I did last month. So, but it's actually something I've thought about, because obviously you have to be a bit skeptical towards the sources, and you are getting these remarkably well-remembered events. And I have to say, after working on the collection for quite a few years, I think you can see weaknesses and strengths. So quite often people will speak confidently about the day that they did something or the date, or they'll talk about who was with them, or they'll talk about numbers. And very often when you can check these facts, they're actually wrong. Mm-hmm. The things that I think are much more kind of authoritative is how people felt at the time, how they experienced something, their sense of what was going to remind them. I mean, they're really excellent in terms of mentality, but in terms of accuracy, I think there's a whole lot of things that you need to be quite careful about. But, I mean, one advantage of the witness statements, I suppose, is there's so many of them. I mean, you can cross-check dozens of statements, for instance, in the different garrisons that the rebels served in. You can cross-check large numbers of statements for particular counties or particular time periods. So there is quite a lot of, there's quite a lot of things which you can do to make sure that they're not being as misleading as you would expect with memory. But again, I suspect that because this collection is so unique and it's because of its size, that it probably will be mined in very interesting ways by oral historians and historians of memory to try and look at how and why some distortions do occur.
Yeah, it's a. I think you could spend a good portion of a scholarly career on a source like that. Let's start talking about the history a little bit. And one of the things that I recalled from my time in Ireland was that there are ordinary English words, and then when you put them in the Irish historical context, they tend to mean different things. There's a whole nomenclature for Irish history, especially modern Irish history. So I wanted to go through just some terms so that the people that listen to this podcast will understand what we mean. So first of all, there's this thing called home rule. What is home rule?
Right, yeah, well, Ireland since 1800 had been under British rule, and in effect it was part of the United Kingdom. I think sometimes overlooked by some Irish people and certainly some people abroad, Ireland in 1916 was it was a democracy. Ireland was part of the UK state. Now, of course, most people who lived in Ireland were nationalists, about three quarters, but the vast majority of nationalists hoped for a moderate address of their grievances, and they hoped for a home rule parliament under the John Redmond's Irish Parliamentary Party, nationalists hoped that they could secure a parliament for Ireland, which would keep Ireland within the United Kingdom. This isn't something particularly they wanted, but this is something they accepted as necessary from the British end. So they would accept the devolution of autonomy, essentially, to Ireland. And that was really the state of play by about 1910, 1911. And at that point, things began to change very rapidly. The Irish Party, who represented most Irish nationalists, held the balance of power at Westminster. Lloyd George's Liberal Party needed their support in his contest with the Tories and the House of Lords, who were blocking his people's budget. So in return for Irish nationalists keeping Asquith's Liberal government in power, home rulers were essentially promised that home rule would come about. The Liberal government's decision then to bring in home rule starts a profound reaction in Ireland, particularly in Ulster, as Ulster Unionists, the minority tradition in Irish politics, radicalise and organise and set up a paramilitary force, the Ulster Volunteers, to fight home rule. And it's that kind of constitutional and political crisis that comes about from what is essentially a very moderate measure, the Home Rule Bill, which sees things spiral out of control. So the people who are responsible for bringing about the Easter Rising, Irish Republicans or Irish Separatists, really represent just a very small minority political opinion up to 1916. Mm-hmm. And of course, the importance of 1916 is that violence, even though it's representative of only a very small section of nationalists, fundamentally changes the picture and brings about a groundswell of popular support for republicanism. So one thing which the Easter Rising does is it kills home rule.
Mm-hmm. Let me go into the second term after home rule, and that is the word nationalist as opposed to republican. These mean one thing in American English, but they mean something quite different, really, in the Irish context. What are
those two things?
Yeah, I mean, perhaps the simplest way of thinking about this is most Irish Catholics were nationalists, which is they wanted some form of independence for Ireland. Most Irish Protestants were unionists. That is, they supported the continuance of the Act of Union, which had come in 1800. Now, in terms of thinking then more about Irish nationalism, normally it's spoken of as being sort of two factions, constitutional nationalists, that is, nationalists who supported the attainment of independence or movement in that direction through constitutional political means. And that is a really important tradition for much of sort of post-1800 Irish history. So popular nationalism really comes about under Daniel O'Connell, the great constitutional nationalist leader in the 1830s, the causes taken further by Parnell in the 1880s and John Redmond by the time of the Easter Rising. Now, there's also a kind of a minority nationalist tradition, which is separatism or republicanism. And again, that has a long lineage. I mean, we could go back to the 1798 Rising, for example, which is when republicanism first begins to become a popular movement in Ireland with Wolfe Tone and the United Irishmen, who organise against British rule and mount an unsuccessful rising. So by the time you get to 1916, there is a republican or a separatist tradition in Ireland, which looks back to that tradition of violent revolutions against British rule in 1798, in 1803 with Robert Emmet, in 1848 with the Young Ireland movement, and in 1867 with the Fenians. But I suppose one important point about the republican or separatist or physical force tradition is that while they certainly had an emotional resonance with a lot of Irish people, they were never politically very popular the first time they sort of achieved significant political success, with the possible exception of the Fenians in the 1860s, is only after the Easter Rising. And we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, Northern Ireland, and one of the issues there is that the use of violence by a small group of people with no democratic mandate, which is subsequently sort of endorsed by the Irish people, became something very problematic with the Troubles.
Mm-hmm. So let's go on to another. Let's actually set the stage a little bit with some players, to put it that way, to use a theatrical metaphor. In your book, one of the things I liked, and there's other things I read about the way the British saw Irish radicalism. Whenever anybody did anything that the British didn't like, they called it Sinn Féin, whether it was Sinn Féin or not. I think similarly with Americans, they see anything that involves politics or violence in Ireland, and they think the IRA. There was no IRA at this point, right? There was there was the Irish Brotherhood. Is that what it was called?
Yeah, I mean, the IRA is really sort of, I suppose, born out of 1916. So one group of key players would be the Irish Republican Brotherhood. And they're also known as the Fenians. And the Fenians actually come from America. Please tell that story. they're largely a product of sort of post-famine mass Irish emigration to America, and indeed around the world, particularly to other imperial countries such as Australia and New Zealand. So one of the really fascinating things about Irish nationalism is that it's partly a product of Irish nationalists abroad. So the Fenians are founded in 1858 in America and in Dublin. In Ireland, they're known as the Irish Republican Brotherhood. In America, they're known as the Fenians, but it's that name which gradually becomes more popular. So you get in America, financial support, an organizational base for Irish Republicans, but perhaps most powerfully, a sort of a popular form of republicanism, which is deeply anti-English, very insurrectionary, very committed to physical force, and that remains that link between sort of Irish and American physical force remains important all the way up to 1916 and of course beyond. But to get back to the IRB are there as one group, and it's the IRB who plan, albeit a minority within the IRB, who planned the Easter Rising. But we also have Sinn Féin. And Sinn Féin were founded in 1905 by Arthur Griffith. And what Griffith was really trying to do was to try and find some kind of middle way between physical force republicanism and constitutional nationalism. His problem with constitutional nationalism was that he felt that something that aimed so low could never really claim to represent legitimate or genuine independence or sovereignty. On the other hand, his problem with republicanism was quite interesting. He just made the simple point that Britain is just too powerful, and it's a country which has become more powerful since the failure of 19th century revolutions. So he felt there's really no point in having a physical force uprising. So Sinn Féin sort of came about as a way of sort of a triangulation, we would now say, between physical force nationalism, which was seen as very commendable and a principled stance but futile, and constitutional nationalism, which was seen as basically too much of a compromise of nationalism. And what's often kind of forgotten, because the Easter Rising becomes known as the Sinn Féin Rebellion, is that the Sinn Féin Party actually didn't support the Easter Rising. As you say, it was this habit of referring to troublesome Republicans as Sinn Féiners, which caused a confusion. But what does happen by 1917, by 1918, is that a newly emergent Sinn Féin does become a Republican Party, which sort of represents the aspirations of the Easter Rising. And so the Easter Rising, in a sense, creates that new Republican Sinn Féin Party, mm-hmm. which goes on to achieve Irish independence, mm-hmm. In the south of the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the people that planned the uprising and why they planned it. I want to ask a background question first, though. What was, and my ignorance here is great, what were the Irish called on to do by the British in World War I?
Not too much, in the sense that the big crisis or potential crisis would have been conscription. When the Great War broke out in Ireland and Britain, the reaction in Ireland, despite the Home Rule crisis, which I'd mentioned, which saw a lot of tensions between unionists or loyalists and nationalists, generally speaking, nationalists were pretty enthusiastic about the war effort. One reason for that, I think, was that John Redmond's Irish Party had secured a Home Rule bill. And the resolution was that the Home Rule bill was put in the statute book, but given that it was a time of war, Home Rule wouldn't be introduced until after the war. So from the point of view of many Irish nationalists, they looked at that this thing which they'd been campaigning for three decades, this big demand had been met. So there was quite a bit of goodwill towards Britain. John Redmond, for various reasons which have been much debated, essentially decided to throw his lot in with the British government during the Great War. So he encouraged members of the Irish Volunteers, which was the main kind of nationalist volunteer or paramilitary force, to join up and serve with Britain. And it's really at this point that constitutional nationalism begins to become a little bit unstuck, because Redmond is seen as really too close to Britain and too enthusiastic about the war. And what begins to happen, I suppose, within a year or two of the war beginning is, you know, reports come back about the reality of life in the Western Front. Fears begin to grow that conscription is going to be introduced in Ireland for the reason that it had been introduced in Britain. And suddenly Sinn Féiners or Irish Republicans begin to get a bit of an opportunity. The wind begins to get behind their sails in terms of using opposition to the war as a popular cause. But Britain, it should be noted, don't introduce conscription, but it's just the fear that they will is something which begins to sort of turn the tide a little bit. But most people would have felt that right up until Easter 1916, Republicans were still very much a small minority, and the Home Rule Party still seemed firmly in control of nationalism.
Mm-hmm. And why did they plan the rising? Was it because they were actually going through a kind of a hard time? And it seems to me that the, as the Soviets used to say, the constellation of forces was moving against the Republicans at this time, that they were basically desperate.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a massively kind of debated subject. I suppose if you take the long view, I mean, Fenianism had been a popular movement in the 1860s. And by the time we get to sort of the early 20th century, that kind of physical force, separatist, revolutionary tradition had really become to look increasingly anachronistic, and it wasn't taken seriously by many people, and there was actually very, very small numbers of Fenians in existence. So the kind of people who, like Sean McDermott and Tom Clark, who would organize the Easter Rising, and they're a really tiny, unrepresentative group, but on the other hand, they're, you know, fanatical, zealous, exceptionally disciplined and well-organized. They've learned a lot of lessons from past Fenian conspiracies going wrong, and so they carry out the planning for the Rising with quite some skill. In terms of what motivated them, I think to a certain extent there would have been a realization that Irish republicanism was beginning to dwindle away. I mean, one important point would have been that for all the kind of nationalist propaganda that presented Britain as a malign entity and so on, you know, Britain had responded increasingly progressively to Irish grievances. So, in the 19th century, the great Irish grievances would have been the refusal to give Catholic emancipation. You know, the fact that inequality was basically enshrined in British law in Ireland. But that issue of Catholic emancipation had been addressed in the 1830s. So the only other really big issue that would have existed in the 19th century would have been the land settlement, which was the fact that the great majority of the land was owned by landlords, many of them Anglo-Irish, who were seen basically as a foreign usurper in terms of the nationalist conception of things. And again, very importantly, in the 1880s, the land question was largely being settled. A series of land acts come in the late 19th and early 20th century, and by the time we get to the eve of 1916, most Catholic tenant farmers now own their own land. So Fenians, I think, would have been aware that the really big grievances that republicanism had fed off had been addressed, and now the last big grievance was being addressed, which was, of course, home rule. It now looked that there would be some kind of settlement which would bring back a parliament to Ireland. So what I argue strongly in the book is that the Easter Rising is essentially it's a kind of a last throw of the dice by very frustrated individuals who are aware that this is probably the last real chance that they will have to gain popular support for what they see as a genuine kind of independence movement. And it had always been part of Fenian thinking, going back to the foundation of the movement in the 1850s, that the only way in which Irish revolutionaries could hope to win freedom would be by having an uprising at a time of international war. Mm-hmm. And again, that thinking actually goes back all the way to the 18th century and arguably back to the 17th century. So Fenians, many of them being perfectly intelligent and astute individuals, realised that it was only with a major ally and with Britain distracted in a major war that they could ever hope to militarily achieve much with a revolution. And these people would have believed genuinely that any attempt to pursue independence through democratic means would have been doomed to failure, because they believed that Britain would not have been willing to concede the substance of independence. So it comes back to this great big fault line between constitutional nationalists and separatists. Constitutional nationalists argued that incrementally using democratic methods, some kind of meaningful progress towards independence could be achieved, and Republicans believed that the only thing that Britain would understand would be armed violence. And of course, that the aspects of that debate resonate all the way up into the recent troubles in Northern Ireland. It's something which is an argument which is very controversial, for that reason.
So,
and the other point I might make, maybe about Fenian thinking during the Easter Rising, is I think by and large the Fenian leaders would have accepted that it was unlikely that their uprising could be successful. That they did have links with Germany, they did hope for German arms to arrive on the eve of the rising. But if you look at the strength of the movement, it was 10 or 12,000 individuals. Not terribly well trained, not terribly well armed, and it's really inconceivable to see how militarily it could have presented much of a challenge to the forces of Britain, which at that time had hundreds of thousands of men in arms on the Western Front. So that has led to a big debate as to, well, what exactly did the rebels want to achieve? Did they actually want to take part? Did they think that it was possible to take part even for a short period? Or was it just really a kind of a spectacular gesture? What Lenin, I think, would have called propaganda of the deed. What I argue in my book, relying very much again on these witness statements, is that there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that the thinking amongst Fenian leaders, not the rank and file, but the leaders, was very much about making a credible gesture, one that could see the Republican tradition survive, one that would see it kind of having a degree of self-respect and integrity, because this is a period in which Republicans haven't risen since the 1860s, and a lot of them are sort of criticised as blowhards and people who are willing to talk about freedom but not do anything. So I argue that largely the Easter Rising, at least for the leaders, is about it's an assertion of credibility to say the separate this tradition still exists. It's still willing to fight for freedom, and the thinking would have been that the consequences of rising, no matter how militarily unlikely victory seemed, would have been better than the consequences of doing nothing, which probably would have seen the death of the Irish Republican tradition. And these people would have believed the death of Irish nationality itself. Their great fear is that Irish people are going to end up like Welsh people or Scottish people, that they will no longer be properly Irish, that they will just become a part of Britain. And while that thinking has been very strongly criticised by all sorts of people, one would have to say that a large amount of that thinking actually holds up, in the sense that the Easter Rising does do many of the things which they believe that it might do, even if it didn't pan out exactly the way in which they had initially hoped. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So how did... let me ask this. When was the Rising first proposed, and how did the Irish Brotherhood prepare for it?
The decision to rise in principle was made very quickly, very soon after the outbreak of the Great War. And again, some people have described this as almost a Pavlovian response. You know, England involved in a major war, Irish revolutionaries must rise. And I suppose the interesting thing about the point at which the IRB leadership, the IRB Supreme Council, agreed to rise is that really circumstances couldn't have been much worse for Irish separatists, because in the autumn of 1914, by the autumn of 1914, Irish nationalism had split. The Irish Volunteer Movement, which had been the large paramilitary movement set up in response to the Ulster Volunteers, split. And well over 90%, probably about 95% of Irish volunteers backed John Redmond's Irish Party. So the Irish Volunteers were reduced from a force of maybe 150,000, 180,000 down to about 5,000 or 10,000 men. So the decision at which it's decided to have a rising seems to have been made with very little thought to whether such a rising would be, you know, credible from a military point of view. How the IRB then go about proceeding to have a rising is probably a pretty good masterclass in bringing about a successful rebellion. The first thing they do is they maintain an incredible degree of secrecy about the rising. And previous Irish rebellions had notoriously been failures because the British government had been very aware of what they were doing, and the various revolutionary movements had been infiltrated. So the IRB Supreme Council, once they decide to have a rising in principle, appointed a military council, which at first involved, I think, two individuals, then three, and then it rises to six or seven individuals. And these people planned the rising, you know, in extreme secrecy. And their plan was predicated on using the wider Irish volunteer body as the kind of foot soldiers of that rebellion. So the IRB infiltrated the leadership of the Irish Volunteer Movement, which was a less Republican, less militant body, but all the same a nationalist enough body. And Irish volunteers were basically expected to obey the IRB when the rising was to be launched. So there's an incredible degree of secrecy, and perhaps also a, you know, slightly amoral dimension to this also, because right up until the rising itself, the volunteers were never told what was going to happen. The original plan was simply that the Irish volunteers would be mobilised on Easter Sunday, and their IRB leaders would start fighting, and the volunteers were expected just to row in. So one could be critical of many aspects of this, but certainly it proved to be an effective way of organising rebellion involving thousands of people without word leaking out. And it's not until relatively late in the day that opponents of the rebellion within nationalism and also the British government began to get wind of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how did they get arms?
Well, they didn't have many arms, to be honest. They would use different... the Irish Volunteers had been in existence since 1913, and at that point one could purchase the odd gun or rifle, but it was a bit of a legal grey area. Volunteers would steal guns from British soldiers. Sometimes they would buy them. Sometimes they would trade them for drink. Sometimes they would pick fights and just grab them. They would also... They made homemade bombs. They made pikes in foundries. But to be honest, all this didn't amount to a very credible military threat. And I mean, one of the reasons in which why the Irish volunteers were sometimes ridiculed was because they would train with wooden staves and that kind of thing. And if you compare them to the Ulster volunteers, which had much stronger links for obvious reasons to the British military, that was a much more militarily formidable body with a much higher number of arms. Now, having said that, the Irish volunteers did organize an arms shipment. So they smuggled arms, which had been purchased in Europe. But again, the numbers aren't huge. You're talking about 1,500 rifles or so. Nothing of the kind that could make a significant difference. So that was yet another one of the sort of the military question marks over the rebellion. Now, the one great hope was that the IRB's contacts with Germany would see Germany send over an arms ship with 30, 40,000 rifles. And that indeed was planned, but the attempt failed just shortly before the Easter Rising. And in fact, it was the interception of that ship by the British authorities which really let the cat out of the bag in terms of an uprising. So one can say that the rising went ahead, albeit postponed on Easter Monday, with no real possibility of success because there wasn't a large army and there wasn't a large body of arms, you know, for that army to use.
Mm-hmm. What did the Germans were approached by the IRB? Is that right?
That's right. Through America again. In fact, through the IRB's links in America.
And what did the Germans? What did the Germans think of this?
Well, it's not quite clear. I mean, the IRB presented a plan to Germany, and some people within Germany seem to have been mildly impressed by the idea that Germany, for relatively little input, could support a rising which could cause Britain huge problems in its own backyard. But what the rebels were asking was for really serious military logistical support. I mean, they wanted German officers, German soldiers, a lot of German arms and so on. And the German military and political authorities never really took the IRB that seriously. So there was some kind of mild support. There was a sort of a diplomatic understanding that a republic would be recognized and so on. But ultimately, Germany felt the whole thing was unlikely to proceed. In fact, one of the sort of well-known subplots of the Easter Rising then is that Sir Roger Casement, who had been in Germany trying to persuade the Germans to support the Rising, actually returns home just days before the Rising is to take place in a desperate attempt to call the Rising off because he believes without proper German support the Rising is doomed to failure. Mm-hmm. And of course Casement was captured. This is really when the Rising becomes the planned Rising becomes widely known. Casement was captured and subsequently executed as a traitor, and neither Casement nor the British authorities felt like making much of the fact that he had actually by that point opposed the rebellion.
Mm-hmm. I see. So let's go to the rebellion itself. It's put off a day. It starts on Monday. Is that right?
Yes, the plans are sort of revealed on Easter Sunday with the capture of Casement and so on, and the leader of the Irish volunteers, Owen McNeill, delivers a countermanding order ordering that no Irish volunteers should come out to march on Easter Sunday. So that really stops the Rising dead in its tracks. The separatist leaders in Dublin want to go on, and they really make the only other decision that's available to them at that time, which is they decide to simply postpone for one day and rise on Easter Monday. So a Rising that originally maybe could have expected to have 10, 12,000 men backing it ended up involving about 1,000 people, mm-hmm. Rising maybe to about 1,500 later in the week, and instead of being nationwide was largely confined to the capital in Dublin.
Yeah, that's right. So they march into the centre of Dublin, and Americans who have been to Dublin will recognize some of the landmarks in what follows, I think. They go to Dublin Castle and almost take it.
Yeah, they occupy five or six large buildings in the centre of Dublin, which were conforming roughly to a circle in the very city centre. The headquarters of the Rising are occupied in the GPO on O'Connell Street, and you mentioned before The Rising as a drama, and in fact there is a sense in which The Rising seems to have been deliberately played out in public in full view, and of course the a majority of the organisers of the Rising and the Military Council actually had been dramatists, and there seems to be no doubt that The Rising is very much intended as propaganda. So the headquarters are centred in the busiest street, in the centre of the busiest street in Dublin, and thousands of people turn out day after day to watch what the rebels are doing. And in fact, people watch fights taking place between British Army soldiers and rebels. It's a remarkably kind of public occasion. The rebel strategy is also unusual from a military point of view, because they march into these large buildings, occupy them, fortify them, and really do nothing. They just wait for the British to come with their heavy artillery and so on, and shell them out of it. So it's difficult to see how there's any kind of strategic attempt to sort of take the initiative. It's very much a gesture.
And they don't really attempt to minimize, or maybe this is stating too much, I don't know, they don't really attempt to minimize civilian casualties.
They don't seem to have given it very much thought. I mean, some individuals like James Connolly believed that Britain wouldn't use heavy artillery in the centre of, I suppose, what was could be regarded as the second great city of the UK. But other Republicans certainly did. What can be said is that all the rebel headquarters were, the rebel garrisons were located in built-up city centre areas in which mostly working-class people lived. Effectively, the area around the GPO, for example, was effectively slums. So the biggest proportion of people who die in the Easter Rising are civilians. And I think most of those were probably killed by the British Army, because they used artillery and they used heavy machine guns. As the fighting proceeded, the British military basically took the view of, well, anybody who's in that area and hasn't left, could be considered a target. From that point of view, I think there's a morally questionable aspect to it. On the other hand, the rebels could never have hoped to fight the British Army in open ground, and the fact that they were able to sort of occupy urban streets gave them, to a certain extent, leveled the odds between hopelessly equipped rebels and professionally equipped soldiers. I mean, one example of this would be the battle which takes place at Mount Street, in which over 200 British soldiers and officers are injured or killed by a force which probably numbered about a dozen volunteers holding strategic areas. So from that point of view, it's kind of militarily understandable why they did it. By the end of the Rising, when the leaders such as Patrick Pearse actually saw the carnage which had been inflicted on the city centre, they seem to have changed their views, and it's given as one reason for the very prompt surrender at the end of the period of fighting.
Mm-hmm. Now, when news of the uprising spread around Ireland, how did people react? Was it popular?
No, it wasn't. The rebels' accounts themselves are quite clear that, by and large, in the capital, they're booed at, they're jeered at, they're spat at. In many cases, during the Rising, and particularly during the surrender, they're violently assaulted by people. The reaction around the country seems to have been, shock and dismay. Nationalist opinion, as much as one can speak about it, seems to be very strongly against the Rising, seeing it as at best foolish, but many would have gone much stronger and seen this as insane or as kind of a criminal. This had been a subject of debate for some time, but the witness statements really make clear that, with the exception of some kind of pockets of support here and there, by and large, the average Irish person seems to have been pretty appalled at what was done. Rebellions in the past might have been a great thing about which one could sing, but the actual reality of what happened in Dublin was pretty shocking, and a lot of people would have said pretty pointless, from a military point of view.
Mm-hmm. So after, I guess it's 5 days, they surrender, and the British authorities put them all on trial. What exactly happens?
Yeah, the best thing the British authorities could have done really would have been to deport the leaders and maybe short sentences for most of the rebels. They found themselves arresting a large number of rebels, over 1,000 of them, and they didn't really know what to do with these people, and conventional trials were out, really, because they didn't really, surprisingly enough, have much evidence against them. They just arrested large numbers of people as they surrendered. So it was really not quite clear what they could do with them. They quickly decided not to use conventional law and order. So most of the rebel rank and file were simply deported and interned in the UK. A lot of them were actually released within a year or so. And most controversially, those who they could prove were leaders, or those who they felt were leaders, were given field general court martials, which involved very little kind of legal safeguards, and they were arrested, tried, and executed within a period of a few days. Mm-hmm. So not another particularly large number of people were executed, 15, but the response which that created really began to galvanize sort of popular nationalist opinion. I think as much because of the way in which it was done. And of course, the vital background to all of this, which we've touched on, was the fact that it was a time of war. So these things could be justified. In fact, they were perhaps even a military imperative in a way which they wouldn't have been if a rising had taken place during peacetime.
And then there's just a remarkable sea change in Irish politics. I'm not quite sure I even really understand it. It happened so quickly, but maybe you could describe what happened in the coming couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, some accounts suggest that the transformation of opinion was almost instantaneous, that as soon as people like Patrick Pearce were put up against a wall and shot, that people converted to republicanism. That was probably the case for some people, but by and large, it was actually a more kind of subtle process. What you have is between 1916 and 1918, when the next general election takes place, is a sort of a steady process of events which put the British government in a difficult position and which increased popular support for republicanism. So there's the execution of the rebels, most obviously. There's the arrest of several thousand people, about half of whom would have been innocent in the weeks and months after the Easter Rising. And while some of these were quickly released, the damage was done. Then there's a period of military rule in Ireland, which lasts up to the end of 1916. And as more people get to hear the Republican side of things, and they learn about the shooting of innocent people by British soldiers during the Rising and other kind of events, the groundswell of opinion begins to grow. And of course, the war effort plays a very important part, because throughout this period, then British policy continues to be driven by military rather than political rationale. So the British authorities in Ireland, which would have been in Dublin Castle, which would have been actually fairly moderate, they're discredited by the Rising and they have to go, and they're replaced by a military governor who basically does things quickly and to a certain degree ruthlessly, because that's what militarily makes sense. And perhaps the best example of the military logic kind of driving events in Ireland would have been the attempt to introduce conscription in 1918, in the spring of 1918. Again, this, from the British point of view, this seems a military necessity, because conscription exists in Britain, and Irish manpower is needed with the difficulties with the war. But from a political point of view, it's entirely counterproductive, and it creates massive popular support for republicanism. So 1916 is obviously very, very important. There may not have been a war of independence and a revolutionary movement without it, but it has to be put in that sort of broader context of what Britain is doing during the war period, which builds mass support for the first time ever for republicanism. And as I said earlier, had Britain responded in a much more measured way, had they, for example, not executed the leaders, it seems likely that there would have been quite a different response in that period.
Yeah, no, and then the Civil War starts in short order, at least it starts in 22, is that right?
Yeah, so in a sense, the War of Independence, which is 1919 to 21, mm-hmm. and the Civil War, 1922 to 23, are very much brought about by the Easter Rising. Mm-hmm. When the prisoners are released from the Easter Rising and the movement begins to reorganize itself, it does so against the background of, you know, massive political support for republicanism. So there's an end-of-war general election in the end of 1918, which shows that Sinn Féin, the party which identifies with what was done in 1916, has mass support. It wins the great majority of seats in Ireland. So it's basically as a consequence of that mass support for republicanism and the demand for an Irish Republic, which the British government can never concede, you know, for wider international and military and political reasons, that brings about the slip towards what eventually becomes a guerrilla war. Mm-hmm. So that takes place 1919 to 21, and it ends with a truce and a treaty in which Britain agreed to give dominion independence to Ireland. And again, the Easter Rising is vital here because for a section of the Republican movement, what Britain are offering is a great improvement on home rule, and it can lead to full independence, and they accept it. But for a large section of republicanism, what they had fought for during the War of Independence was what Pierce and his comrades had died for in 1916, and that was a full Irish Republic. And for them to accept anything less was a betrayal. So the Easter Rising and its sort of moral impact is at the centre of the Civil War, which of course divides then Irish nationalism for decades to come.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So let me ask you this. How is the Easter Rising remembered today in the North and the South, if there's any difference?
There are monuments and things, aren't there?
Yeah, it's remembered very differently north and south, and the way in which it's remembered changes over time. So broadly speaking, from the 1920s to the 1950s, in Southern Ireland anyway, the Easter Rising was seen as, I suppose, the equivalent of Independence Day in America or the Bastille in France. It's a fairly uncomplicated, good thing to be celebrated. It's where Irish independence came from. Of course, in the north, because you had a state in which the majority of political opinion was unionist, the feeling was quite different. So for the minority in the north, the Easter Rising was obviously a good thing, but there was no sort of open... It was commemorated, but the commemoration of the Easter Rising was seen as something subversive, whereas commemoration of the Easter Rising was almost something that was mandatory by different southern governments in the south. Everything changes fundamentally in the 1960s and the 70s, and there's two interconnected reasons for this. One is that historians, particularly revisionist historians, come to ask difficult questions about the Easter Rising, such as pointing out, for example, that it didn't have popular support, that maybe there might have been more peaceful methods in which independence could have been pursued. So that debate finally begins to take place 50 years after the Rising. But the other factor, which I think is much more important, is that the Troubles breaks out in the North, and you get the emergence of the Provisional IRA, which is a movement which only has minority support, even amongst the Catholic nationalist community in the North. And it's a movement which, as much as it cares about these things, bases its legitimacy, its mandate on Irish history, and particularly the revolutionary tradition, and particularly 1916. And the argument is made that if it was good enough for people like Pierce to fight against British rule to achieve a united Irish Republic, then there's no reason why present-day Republicans shouldn't do it. And what that basic argument, which is very simple, and there's quite a lot of substance to the argument, that really creates problems for the Southern government, because the Southern government's celebration of independence is bound up with the revolutionary violence of 1916. And so the difficulties in its position of endorsing violence in 1916, but condemning provisional violence, which it sees as immoral and a threat to the Irish state itself, that really gives a massive emotional kind of injection into the revisionist debate, which ran on until the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And then the final way in which this debate has subsequently changed is, of course, the IRA ceasefire in the 1990s, and it began to become much more acceptable then, particularly in the South, for nationalists to reclaim that kind of Republican revolutionary period. One example of this would be the military parade, which takes place at O'Connell Street every Easter. That parade stopped in the early 1970s, largely because of the Troubles context, and that parade came back for the first time in 1996 for the 90th anniversary, and it was, you know, largely in the context of the ceasefire and republicanism becoming a bit more respectable, and also a degree of political self-interest, Southern republicanism wanting to guard against the inroads made by the Northern Republican Sinn Féin political move. So it's kind of complex, but certainly one can see these quite dramatic changes taking place in the legacy of the Rising in different periods of time.
Mm-hmm. I find all that fascinating. Let me ask you one final question, and I'll let you go because we've taken up a lot of your time, and that is that anyone who's traveled around Ireland or lived there for a long time knows that in the center of most every Irish town or city, there's a set of streets, one of which is always O'Connell Street, and there might be a Wolfe Tone Street or something like that. There's no John Redmond Street anywhere I ever saw. Why is there no Redmond Street? Or is that a ridiculous question?
No, it's not. I mean, my street in Bray, where I was born, is Davitt Street, and it's beside Parnell Street.
Yeah, Parnell Street. There you go. There's another one.
Yeah, Davitt and Parnell were part of the Irish Party, Constitutional Nationalists, but they were seen as kind of the respectable end of things because Parnellism was seen as a kind of radical constitutional nationalism, and Republicans looked back on him favourably. Broadly speaking, John Redmond and the Irish Party tradition was, you know, to a certain extent, they became the enemy for Sinn Féin, for Republicans during the period of the Great War. And the fact that the great majority of Irish nationalists had supported constitutional nationalism, and that, in fact, 50,000 or 30,000 Irishmen had died in the Great War, mm-hmm. and 200,000 Irishmen had fought in the British Army. All this became a bit of an embarrassment to the Republican state, which basically, you know, saw itself as representing the anti-war tradition. So from the 20s right up until the 90s, there would have been a tradition of a kind of amnesia, a bit of embarrassment about constitutional nationalism and about the fact that most Irish nationalists were constitutional nationalists. And again, it's with the peace process that kind of thinking has begun to change, and it's become much more acceptable, even popular, for Republicans to look back and sort of reclaim that part of the Irish past, and, you know, to accept that actually things were maybe a little bit more complex than the simple ways in which we tend to compartmentalise these things in retrospect. But Redmond, I think if you wait a long time for a Redmond Street, his name still provokes controversy, and he's seen as someone who sends out Irishmen to die on the Somme.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. No, I just thought he was I'd never really read anything about him before I read your book, and I thought he was kind of a fascinating character because he seems to be he's been kind of written out of the story, and maybe I'm wrong about that because I don't know a lot of Irish history, but he just seemed like somebody who was overtaken by events. Well-intentioned person, probably a good politician, but just overtaken by events.
I think that's right. I mean, he was a figure who tried to come up with a middle way between republicanism and between Ireland being part of Britain. And his fortune rises and falls. And, you know, with a certain kind of political viewpoint at the moment, his stock is actually rising in because he seems to be someone who's toying with compromises. Mm-hmm. And because of what's going on in Northern Ireland, we actually are back in a period of some sort of constitutional compromises. And maybe people are a little bit more willing to look back in the past and see, well, you know, maybe there could have been other things could have happened in different ways, and that's what I hope partly the book will restore, is a sense of kind of the complexities of the past that existed at the time, because in retrospect these things seem very simple.
Well, it does that, I think, really marvelously, and you uttered the word even-handed earlier in our conversation, and I think your book is very even-handed. I came, you know, often when I think about these things, especially ones that end up in bloody violence like this one, you know, I have trouble finding any heroes among any of these people. They were all very brave. I'll give them that. But it seems like cooler heads did not prevail. And that's kind of a sad thing. So anyway, Fergal, thank you very much for being on the show. I should tell our listeners that we've had Fergal McGarry on the show, and we've been talking about his terrific book, The Rising Ireland, Easter 1916. Fergal, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks, Marshall.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Fergal McGarry about his new book, The Rising, Ireland, Easter 1916. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.